Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Meta. I'm your host, Jay Larson, and joining me this week, I can think of no better guest for the triumphant return of The Meta than William Hungerford.
Triumphant return?
Yes.
What happened?
Basically my life collapsed around me, and and I haven't done a podcast in too long, so... yeah.
Well, we're going to welcome things back with a positive attitude and a cheery demeanor. Post-life collapse.
Sweet. Well,
let's talk about toys.
Well. We have something very important to discuss first, Mr. Hungerford.
Is it the Dune trailer?
Yes, the Dune trailer has released. Did you watch it?
Yeah, I watched it.
Okay, and what did you think?
It looked interesting. I did not expect to see a beardless Jason Momoa. So that was unique to see. I think Batista's character looks good, and I think all the character designs look good in it. I think the sandworm at the end, they did proper justice for its scale. I think, and this is not necessarily for Dune, but this is an overall sort of general statement. I'm getting a little tired of the trend of slowed down old songs on trailers. Like, that's a thing now. Mm-hmm. Well, it's been a thing for a while. And it's just like every trailer, especially epic trailers that come out, like it starts off usually with like wow. You get a couple wows and a couple like duns. And then like the music kicks in and all of a sudden I'm listening to, the Animals, House of the Rising Sun, but slowed down to like chopped and screwed level. And I'm like, all right, cool. No, like, but maybe not. So yeah, I'll see the movie. It's not the most exciting trailer I've seen in the last several months, but not by far.
Whoa.
That's the Batman. Like the Batman trailer was amazing.
I don't know that I've even watched that yet, to be honest.
Yeah, it's been a good podcast, Jay. It's been good talking to you. You haven't seen the Batman trailer?
I don't think I have.
You need to go watch that after this is done.
Okay, I'll tell you what. I will watch it and tweet at you about it.
Okay, please do.
Okay. I don't have the hang-ups over Pattinson that most people have, so at least...
people shouldn't at this point, especially when it comes to Batman stuff. Like, Heath Ledger being the Joker, everyone lost their mind. Turns out to be great. Joaquin Phoenix going to be the Joker again. Everyone loses their mind. Turns out to be great. When Michael Keaton was first assigned the role of Batman back in the 89 Burton movie, people were like, what? Keaton is Batman? And it turned out to be great. Like, as we all know, the Gothamverse and Batman is one of the best things that's ever been created on this planet. And people need to have faith that, these actors are going to work out. I love Batman.
I understand, yeah. And in these dark times, I'm glad that there can be any shining light of something that brings joy to your life, Will. So
now, I watched the Dune trailer 3 times. How many times did you watch it?
Oh, I've probably watched it 5 or 6 times now. But I watched it and then, like, I haven't been, I had been in kind of a reading funk. Mm-hmm. Because I enjoy reading a lot, but as with many things, when you're depressed, it's difficult to get enjoyment out of the things that you enjoy. Mm-hmm. But I will say that the Dune trailer got me excited enough to reread Dune, and I've been enjoying that quite a bit. And I'm about a third of the way through since the trailer dropped, so
nice.
Said plugging along at it, so that's been good.
Think of all the new memes that are going to come out of that movie, because there'll be new
still
shots.
Speaking of which, I have one for you now.
God, do we have to do this?
We have to, yes.
Alright.
This might be my favorite Dank Doom meme of all time now.
Oh, okay.
And I'm going to tell it to you, and you're just going to be like, what WTF are you even that is going on about right
my
now.
My normal reaction every time.
Excellent. Well, I would hate to disappoint. Okay. Okay, so I particularly love that it combines with like another meme format that I tend to just love. Okay, so here we go. Dank Dune meme, it says, "It's only jihad if it's from the Siege Tabar region. Otherwise, it's just Sparkling Crusade." Oh my god, Ungerford, it's amazing!
I'm glad we did that.
I am too. As a little bit of I guess background on that.
No, it's better if you don't explain it.
No. It's you need to have like some of the full, you know, cultural weight behind this awesome meme. So there's a little bit of like there would be issues if this book written in the 1960s was written today, believe it or not.
Surprise.
Over, like, there's a lot of similarities between one of the space races and what stereotypes about Muslims. And they go on jihads and stuff like that. And so they were kind of wondering, like, you know, how are they going to handle that in the movie? And in the movie, they don't mention jihad, but they do mention a crusade. So that's makes it all better, I guess. So with that out of the way, the greatest Dune meme of all time shared, we can move on to talk about War Machine. I'm excited.
I'm excited, too. I was just thinking, like, when you're talking about, like, you know, a book written in the 60s not being appropriate today. I read a fair amount. I would say I read a lot. Like, I'm not a crazy reader, but my favorite book, my favorite piece of literature is Arabian Nights.
Okay.
Like, I read that often. And because, I mean, just you can read the whole thing. You can read the whole Scheherazade and the tales sort of in order, or you can just read a tale, right? You don't have to do it in any specific order. Mm-hmm. Man, I usually read Richard Burton's, Sir Richard Burton's translation of it. And there's certain parts where you're just like, yeah.
Big yikes.
Yeah, like, I just read that, but like, ugh. I will say, I got a new translation of Aladdin that my sister got me. A French-Serbian translation of it. It was quite good. Even though Aladdin was added much, much later. But anyway, we're gonna get off on a tangent. Let's talk about War Machine.
Okay, when we get to the other episode, speaking of your sister, I'll probably talk about you, your family, and Disney.
So. Okay, yeah, we can talk about that.
Okay.
Sorry, the Southern brother in me just came. I was like, don't you talk about my sister?
No,
don't you include her in a Dank Dude meme?
Okay. All right, so as a reminder, we'll have two episodes around 45, 50 minutes, and the first one will be free, and the next one will be a bonus episode for people who support the Patreon. So if you're not supporting the Patreon, go check it out. It is, instead of, one of the things I did on purpose was set this up as a per creation Patreon instead of a monthly, so that my hope was that I wouldn't hardly ever miss weeks, which has been kind of the way it's gone, but I don't want to charge people for something if I do have, if my life happens to collapse around me, then I don't want you to be charged for that. So, let's... Thank you. Let's dive into the questions from the Patreon subscribers. So, the first one is from Dragon Pup. Mm-hmm. He says, on the subject of Rhett, well, we know it's far enough out that you cannot necessarily give specifics, but feel free to prove us wrong. What do you feel are the pain points for Rhett as a faction?
What I feel are the pain points?
Yeah. What are the areas that you think that Rhett players are kind of struggling with at the moment?
Oh, that is I mean, there's definitely an overall mindset that there's only a handful of things playable in the faction. If you're speaking from the majority competitive mindset, you know, mm-hmm, and then I'd say speaking casually or not even top end competitive, not much of this applies, but a lot of people feel very locked into like the Trident and a very limited selection of casters. You know, after the Trollblood CID ends, the next, there's like this little Grimkin block with the Defiled Archon and Isaiah the Dread Harvester, and then also the Death Archon, which is not a Grimkin model, comes out during that. And then the next block is Retribution. So the plan is to do a CID for it. I don't expect the Ret one to be as large as the Legion and Troll ones were, which was like 24, 26 legacy models. Not to say it's going to be minute by any means. Don't expect like, you know, just 5 or 6 legacy models. But I think there is a handful of things, and I think a little bit of massaging that can be done to some of the theme forces. I think the one thing that Ret players really want is just more viability in their options. And I could definitely see taking an approach to it similar to the Legion one, where we're going to choose certain aspects of infantry, like how like Nis got a heavy look in the Legion one. And make sure that whichever block of infantry or style of infantry we look at, like, I'm not saying this will be it, but say we chose Mage Hunters, for example, and then making all the Mage Hunter units and solos, you know, function at the same level of viability at the rest of the army. So I think the pain point right now is that Retribution players just don't feel that all their options are competitively viable. Not every option will be. Not when you have factions of this size, right? Like if you're trying to play for the top tables, you're always going to look for the top 10% of what's available in your faction. But I think they just don't feel like their top 10% has a lot of wiggle room, and we'll see what we can do about that.
Okay. So he did have some follow-up questions with it.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned themes. He says, will any of the themes themselves be reworked? I know that when Themepocalypse came upon us, or the big revision of themes, a lot of the Ret players were in particular pretty unhappy with the end result on their themes.
Mm-hmm. I do think that people should expect to see, because there is not a new theme coming with the CID, much like the Legion one didn't have a new theme. But we did end up making some, it was a minor alteration, just to Children, adding the throne in, and obviously adding the new models in. But I think seeing some benefit changes, army composition changes in one or two themes in the Ret CID is not out of the question. Now, we're still in the playtest cycle for that, like the internal one. So it's hard for me to say for sure, like, oh yeah, you know, you expect the Mage Hunter theme force to, you know, expect Shadows to get all these changes. Because that may not be the case, but I can tell you that we're looking at it, and it is on our mind, and it's something that we are very heavily considering if that's the route that things need to go, which it very well might be. I just don't want to get your hopes up in case it doesn't.
I don't know that there's much you need to say or can say on this, but like when you mentioned like we're in the internal development phase on this right now, like, mm-hmm. It just seems like that must be have an extra layer of difficulty right now.
So. I mean, we're very busy people, right? Like, I, on any given day, am swapping gears between War Machine rules, design and development and playtesting, Riot Quest design, development, and playtesting, the IKRPG 5e development and review, and then things like, you know, running a CID, launching a dynamic update, and doing podcasts with wonderful people. So it's busy. It's busy time.
Well, hopefully it'll keep you out of trouble.
No, God, no.
Okay, so another follow-up question from Dragon Pup. He says, for the love of God, give us some teases / spoils to what casters will be in the CID cycle.
The new one, for sure. 100%.
The for the love of God part might have been thrown in by me, but...
Oh. I mean, the new caster will be there for sure. And I am very excited for people to get to use her new mechanic. I say new mechanic, new application of an existing mechanic, but something we haven't seen before. I mentioned this somewhere else, but I'll tell you here. One mechanic I've always wanted to see in War Machine was something where you put a type of token on enemy model/units that you can have more of one on, and that your army could spend those tokens off of them to have a menu of effects available to them. And the new caster does that. The new caster has bounty tokens that you get to start with some of them in play. You get to have spells and abilities on her that add more. And then she herself has a menu of things that says, you know, during your activation phase, you can spend these tokens off an enemy model/unit, and this is the effect it generates. Like, it could be something like maybe you snare it and slow it down, or maybe like you get a prey style ability for a model in your army, or a model/unit in your army, depends. But I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I think choosing where those tokens go, then choosing how you apply them is going to be a lot of fun. So Rhett's getting kind of a brand new take on an old mechanic.
Well, that sounds exciting. You mentioned it's a her. Is this going to be a incarnation of another caster that we've already seen, or is it a brand new caster?
This is a brand new Elawir warcaster, because the Rhett new block is all House Elawir based, and she is terrifying. You'll have to see her. She's not a nice lady. And she's the kind of lady that would cut you in half, down the center, for saying the wrong thing. She's a badass in hand-to-hand combat. And then she just does a lot of really cool support stuff, cool ways to deliver your army. And this bounty token stuff does make it like, when people are going to probably look at their spell list first, and be like, oh, wait, you know, where's the straight powerhouse spells? Where's deflection? Where's defender's ward? Stuff like that. And it's like, no, you got to look at the bounty mechanic, because the bounty mechanic is going to be the way that you end up delivering the army. Like, you know, I'm not saying this is one of them, but like, if there's a bounty that says, you know, spin this bounty token off an enemy model/unit that's got one on it in your activation phase, that model/unit can't make ranged attacks for one round. It's going to be different effects like that, that where you could just be like, I'm not worried about making my range def higher. I'm just going to say the thing I'm worried about can't shoot. And then you start playing this game where you're trying to get more and more of these bounty tokens out and on the right models so that you can spin them in the right way, either offensively or defensively. It's led to some really fun lines of play. So
I understand that she's not coming out in this CID cycle, but I need you to understand, Mr. Hungerford.
I'm listening.
That I need to have Assyria 2 in my life.
So okay.
Get on that.
okay, noted. It may not be how you want.
No, well, whatever.
So, okay, let me pitch this to you versus off the top of my head. So you want Assyria 2. That's the monkey's paw wish you made, is you want Assyria 2. Okay. So what we'll do is Arcadius gets his hands on Assyria. Fluff-wise. Okay.
Yeah.
And he just stitches her into a pig from the waist up. Not even a warhog, like a razor boar. And so Assyria 2 is this like Muppet flailing, screaming torso stitched into a razor board that's just running full tilt because it's panicked because there's an elf stitched into it screaming.
I'm all in.
All right, done. I'll pitch it to Matt later.
Awesome. Okay. Final question from Dragon Pup on this set of questions. Yeah. He says, if you added up the number of axes being held by upcoming rep models, how many axes would that be?
Are we counting units as individual, like each, the axes they're holding? Should I count one for each model in the unit?
Yes.
Okay. That's an interesting question. Do pole axes count?
They count as 0.5 each.
Oh, okay. Well, that actually changes the math significantly. Okay. So if pole axes only count as 0.5, they're way bigger than a normal axe.
Sorry, 1.5 then. I don't know.
1.5? Okay. Then that would make it, it would be 7.5. Then you add the solo, which would be 3. That'd be 10.5. We'd go to 12 for the caster. And then for the jack, man, those are, that one's really big. 12. I still just count them as 1.5. So I would say 15, because everything in the new model release has an axe of some kind.
Okay.
Every ret model has a pole axe or like an axe cleaver. Ain't no swords.
Okay. So the magnificent Bambleweenie has a question for you.
I'm sorry. What?
The magnificent Bambleweenie, which, for the record, his profile pic is adorable. It is a panda gazing back at you. He says, in retrospect, are you happy with the power level of Armored Core? They're a fantastic looking group of models, and it's a real shame that they don't see much table time.
See, that's... things like they don't see much table time isn't true. They don't see a lot of top-end competitive table time. Mm-hmm. Manowar, in general, are very popular, especially with new players.
Right.
Armored Core is very straightforward. It's very easy to play. And you can do reasonably well at it, especially if you're trying to get into the game and trying to learn what all these other factions and what everything else does. The model selection, again, everything is just like, I'm tough and I hit hard if I get there, right? And it's got a few little tricks here and there. You know, not every list, not every theme force is always going to make the top tables. I say this a lot, but like the factions are just too big. The idea that every theme force, especially in the original factions like Kador, Krix, Protectorate, would be top end competitive is just not really viable. As long as in like WTC, VTC, Iron Gauntlet, Masters style play, each faction has somewhere between, in my opinion, 3 to 5, and not, I'm not saying they all do, but as long as every faction has about 3 to 5 lists that can like really compete with whatever the current meta is, that feels right. The thing is, the meta also rotates and it changes based on new releases. Mm-hmm. So whereas Manowar right now are not likely in that 3 to 5 for Kador, that doesn't mean that they might not end up being later. So, and were we happy with the power level of Armored Core? Yes. Is that power level at the high end of the spectrum? No.
One of the things that, so as a retailer, one of the things that can be a bad experience or that you don't want to see is when someone comes into the game, they don't like, it's very easy to be overwhelmed and be like, okay, what should I buy? And like, I had a customer who came to my shop and he was like, I am all in on playing the Arcane Tempest Gun Mages because I think they look awesome and that's what I want to play. And he bought a bunch of Gun Mages and he came to game night and he just got rolled over and over and over. And he finally was like, well, I'm done playing War Machine. And that's I guess a type of experience that, you know, you don't want to see happen. Do you feel like Armored Core is a strong enough purchase that someone's not going to have buyer's regret afterwards, or that
I think there's too many variables to answer that like definitively, because the player that shows up with Son of the Tempest, like your meta is probably pretty adept, right?
Yeah.
And so there's a lot. Like, the game is very deep. The game is very skill based. The more skilled you are, the better you will do. So coming in as a new player can be difficult.
Yes.
And even then, like, say you just netlist and you give a new player like the strongest thing they can possibly face. A lot of those have really complex interactions, right? They end up doing a lot of like really, like, if a new player came in and was like, I heard that Strange Bedfellows is really good, I want to start with that. Like, that's a weird place to try and start learning the game, right? Or if they wanted to start with Flames, just because there's so many interactions and so much to learn. But things like Sons of the Tempest, you know, things like Armored Core. And then there are some that are still very powerful that I would say are very straightforward, like Exalted. I mean, I know Exalted has fallen out of favor in the meta recently, but Exalted's pretty straightforward overall. I mean, it's got its tricks when you get the higher level, but for a new player starting with, let's say, a basic 75-point list, they can learn that stuff as they go. So part of it is the skill level of the people they're playing with, because you could also be handed the best list in the world, and if you're just getting the War Machine and you're playing in a Shark Tank, you're going to get rolled. Mm-hmm. You're going to get rolled nonstop.
Yeah.
I think as communities, part of it is, okay, what do you want to play? All right, I want you to play this thing because that's attracting you to the game. Right. And then as they come in the meta, sort of just let them know the deal. Like, if everyone there plays nonstop, hardcore, competitive, 75-point steamroller only, well, you've already got a barrier of entry to that new player. So maybe like have a couple people that are just going to be like, okay, I'll step it down. Oh, you only own 50 points worth of stuff? Sure. You know, I haven't played this caster in forever because I only care about competitive play. So I'll play this thing I own just for fun, and then, you know, ease them in. And then as they learn and then they see what the high end stuff is, then they can make new purchasing decisions. And I think people won't have buyer's remorse as long as there is value to their miniatures in some capacity. But if you walk into a meta that's just playing competitively, you're reducing the value on a wide selection of the brand, because not everything is going to be viable across the board.
Yeah, it's not an easy issue to deal with.
I mean, but. Yeah, it's, I love Midas as an example. I love Midas. I think Midas is just a ton of fun to play when I play minions lists. I understand that if I was going to go play in a tournament, Midas is not the warlock I'm going to reach for. I'm going to reach for Rask. I'm going to reach for Azazello. I'm going to reach for Arcadius. And minions is a smaller faction than, you know, Signar and Kador by a lot. But I could also just go in and talk to people and be like, hey, this is the kind of list I want to play. So, you know, you want to bring your A game? Then I'll bring my A game. Oh, do you want to, you know, not bring your A plus game? Then, hey, this is what I'm going to do. It's the other, I feel like we're losing a little bit of the conversation sometimes that part of the social contract requires is saying, this is what I'm trying to do, or me asking, what are you trying to do? Coming to an understanding, and then us building two forces that play well against each other.
Okay, so next question we have from Jay Murph. He says, what can you tell us about the Death Archon and the Grimkin Archon?
Sure. I can tell you there's a preview going up. Might be the next week, but it might be next month. I don't remember when they scheduled it for. I wrote it a couple weeks ago that shows the in-play test rules for both. So people will get a full spoiler on what the Death Archon and the Defiled Archon currently do. The Defiled Archon is a Grimkin-only Archon, much like the Blight Archon is a Legion-only one. The Defiled Archon, the route I went with it is the spell-slinging Archon. We didn't have an arcane Archon. So it's got a magic ability befitting an Archon with a menu of spells and is very good at using them, and has tricks around using them, has some unique spells that are only now in Grimkin and aren't on any of their warlocks, and also benefits other spells in the army, which I know you've only got like really the warlocks and Twilight Sisters and stuff like that, but the benefit it does provide is useful model in Grimkin that can cast a spell. And we've seen some really fun interactions come out of that, but just by itself, say it wasn't trying to do its supporty kind of thing it could do, which it does just by doing its attacks anyway. Like, it doesn't like require a separate action to do its support stuff. If it's blowing stuff up with spells, you are getting this benefit. But yeah, it just sort of bounces, flies around, teleports around the battlefield, and then just lays down magic firepower on the enemy, kind of tailored to however you need it. So it's fun. The Death Archon, I think when people see it, they're... It's got two range three sights that both have Blood Reaper, which is the... You basically Thresher attack, but it's not Thresher. And then it's got Chain Attack Death Chill, Chain Attack to Stationary. And it collects corpses, not souls, and then it has a bunch of things it can do with those corpses that make it really, really scary, one of which is being able to sidestep. So this thing can fly in, swing at everybody within 3 inches of it, sidestep and swing at everybody within 3 inches of it, and if it hit the same target twice for the chain attack, sidestep and then do a big chain attack stationary on everybody as it death chills them. It's a lot of fun. It is the first Archon that... Both of these Archons don't have Soul Ward. They both do things with souls in a fashion, but they don't have Soul Ward. The Defiled Archon actually punishes you for taking souls. It doesn't prevent you because it does some very grimkiny things. Whereas the Death Archon collects corpses, and it has a way that the things it kills don't provide souls, but it itself doesn't do Soul Ward for your own army. The most interesting thing I think people are going to see on the Death Archon is it has animosity other Archons. Specifically other types of Archons is the way it's written. So you can run multiple, you can run two Death Archons in the same list, but you can't run a Death Archon with any other type of Archon. And it has vendetta other types of Archons. So as people will learn, the Death Archon has shown up and does not seem to get along. In fact, actively seeks out and hunts down other Archons. But with Vendetta Archon, you can just use it to go in and just straight murder any other Archon it gets into touch with. But even if your opponent's not running Archons, which a lot of lists are, this thing will just mulch through most infantry, elite or regular. And you can go into a heavier target or targets and stationary them with the death chill. Other than that, it's got some other pretty nasty tricks he can pull off.
I will say that all sounds pretty exciting, so I'm looking forward to seeing those.
Yeah, I'm ready to see the sculpts. I haven't seen the sculpts yet, just the concept art.
Yeah, the concept parts, from what I remember of them, were quite impressive.
I'm just excited to see what that both of them look like in person.
Yeah. All right. So next question from No Howard. He says, assuming the Legion updates are live by the time of the recording, which I didn't think they would be, but they are. So huzzah.
Mm-hmm.
He says, can you share the highlights of the tuning that happened between the end of CID and the release?
It was actually pretty minor. We were really happy with where Legion CID ended. We did more playtests. Major change, the major last buff that came through was that Hex Hunters and Bale picked up Apparition. That was something that was discussed in CID for quite some time. And then we continued to test it afterwards and then determined it was the last piece of the puzzle they needed. That was the major tune up. The only real tune down post-CID worth mentioning is that Bethane 2's feet did end up with the living keyword, which was a thing that was kind of off and on in the CID. Ultimately, we did not want it working on the Blight Archons, and we did not want it working on objectives. We do felt it was confusing. There is a line in the rulebook that I think a lot of players, and especially new players, wouldn't get, which is that so you can't target and damage an objective until the second player's second turn. That's in Steamroller. And the feat allows you to transfer to anything. So if it didn't have living, you could choose the objective as one of the targets that you could transfer to. There's a line in the core rulebook that says, if a model cannot suffer damage, you cannot transfer to it. That just gets overlooked because it never comes up. Like, I can't think of many times that rule has ever mattered. And this is one of them. And we already saw people asking a lot of questions and sending us private messages and rules form questions about what happens if I choose the objective. And so we're like, okay, that's too confusing. And then we also just looked at the survivability of the Blight Archon and what it was doing, which we did tone down the power of its spray from 14 to 12, again, based on CID. And we're like, we didn't want it to have this extra transfer from that thing too. So the spawning vessel, Mechano Shredders, objectives, and the Blight Archon are the non-eligible targets for the feat. Other than that, it's basically all the buffs and changes you saw in CID, and the reaction thus far, it went live yesterday, has been very positive. I would say the Legion community is majority quite happy with everything that went down.
He also he had some follow-up questions related to the Legion updates. He says, how do you feel about the outcome relative to your original objectives?
Great. I think we got there. I think the Legion CID is one of the best CIDs in terms of just overall. Like, it was the No Battle Report one, which was super risky. It went really well. The community was super chill. Everyone, I think we only had to ban one person during the entire cycle. Everyone just got to just...
What's the normal amount of banning in a cycle?
More than one.
Okay, okay.
I mean, everyone just gave us the kind of feedback we were looking for. There was really great, like, civil discussions and debate and discourse. We were able to pull a lot of great data and feedback out of it, and it went super duper well, given that it could have gone really, really bad, being the No Battle Report style. So I'm not going to say it's hard to say it's the best one, because the ones where we were able to accept battle reports, we've had ones that, you know, were better because of that. But I think with the restriction and the challenge of this one just sticks out to me as just going very well despite those odds. So we're super happy.
His final question with Legion is, how do you feel about the faction overall now?
Great. I mean, I think the faction has a lot of different options. Okay. I think the faction is welcoming to new players. I think the faction has theme force and lists that a new to intermediate player can stick with for a while as they learn the game of War Machine, which isn't just learning what your list does, but it's learning all the other stuff that's out there. And I think it's got fun, fluffy narrative lists you can very easily build. And I think it's got competitively viable lists. I think it's got in that 3 to 5 list range of things that you could run. Because I definitely see people running. I think Primal Terrors is still going to be really strong. I think there's going to be a lot of new Children of the Dragon, builds coming out of it. And I'm seeing a lot of talk today specifically just about people being really happy with the new Archangel and what they're planning to do with it, which casters they want to try and get the most out of it. So yeah, I'm just, for a faction to take all the boxes, it needs to sort of hit all those categories. Can I learn it as a new player? Can I stick with it as a new player as I learn the rest of the game? If I'm a narrative player, if I'm like Jay Larson and I'm a fluff bunny, does it have a strong theme? Can I just play an Oblivion campaign and tell a story? And then do I have a reasonable amount of viable tournament lists? I think Legion, the answer is yes to all those.
All right. So next question is from Dr. Glenn. He says, do you feel like Crucible Guard's themes need to be reworked somehow? It feels like you can play MO or put yourself at a disadvantage most of the time. MO being Magnum Opus, sorry.
No, I don't think the themes themselves need to be reworked. I think we want to look at the options within those themes. Because if someone feels like they're at a disadvantage being in just Magnum Opus, is it the other theme force that's the problem? Or, you know, the one or two benefits it's granting, you know, a little bit more than that. Or is it what's available to it? Now, as a limited faction, you do have less themes to work with, right? And so...
I mean, I guess real quick to interject, one of the things that is a little bit weird about the Crucible Guard themes in particular that are kind of unique compared to everyone else's. You have the Prima Materia theme that is, it has some cool benefits, but you're restricted with what you can take. Uh-huh. And the other one is,
like, everything.
You can take everything. Yeah. And you still have some really good theme benefits, and some that are probably arguably better than the other one, other theme. It kind of seems weird how we got there, because it kind of seems to not follow the design philosophy that Preptor Press intended with theme forces. Mm-hmm. Now, granted, it's a little bit different with limited factions, but I guess I'm kind of curious on your thoughts on kind of that situation.
No, and that's what I'm getting at is, so we look at, you know, what's available, and Crucible Guard is a really unique one, because we've had this conversation internally a lot of times as with Grimkin and Crucible Guard specifically. And so it's like, you've got this one, right? That's magnum opus. And what is it doing specifically, and what's it available? And then you have to look at the other one and what the differences are, and what's available to it. And then what are those models doing, and do those models need to change? And then, are they operating within that theme force? Like, is there a reason to play that other theme force based on just those options? And if the answer is no, then we need to look at things. But we are in a weird state with the Crucible Guard one, because like you said, one of them is kind of a kitchen sink one for Crucible Guard. And the other one is very specific. Like, it's not all units, right? It's just the medium-based Crucible Guard units, Combat Alchemists, and Dragon Breath. Whereas the other one just says Crucible Guard units, right?
Mm-hmm.
Also, you know, one of the things is that Magnum Opus can take a Merc unit, Merc Solar.
Merc options, while the other can't.
The other can't. And that's some of the stuff I look at is like, okay, if we're taking this limited selection, what do these models do, and how are they interacting, and what is the benefit? Sometimes the answer is just we need to change the models to make those models work better. And then sometimes it's that we need to make them work better in the theme force, giving them a specific benefit. And then sometimes the answer is we have to completely change the theme force based on what's available. For Crucible Guard, we're still in the ret cycle. We've got the Crucible Guard stuff concepted, and like the sort of the rules ideas of where we're going with them. But we're not at the point where we started making the major adjustments to any theme forces. So I couldn't tell you one way or the other which way we'll go. But the first thing that we're going to look at is, what are the models? How are those models performing? And then we're going to kind of go through the iterations and step through there.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's kind of interesting about it is that kind of the natural... it seems like the natural desire that a lot of players have is that they're like, I want to have these really broad theme forces that, you know, allow me to have as many list building options as possible. And in a lot of ways, that's kind of what Magnum Opus is for Crucible Guard. But then you mm-hmm. do kind of get to the situation where you're kind of left with, like, maybe the unintended or at least a consequence of a lot of times, like, oh, well, now there isn't really a point to look at some of the other theme forces because of the way this other one is. So, I don't know.
And if that ends up being the case, that's when we'll, like I said, we'll go through the iterations of start with the models. Are the models functioning? Then what is the theme force doing for those models? In the case where you have two theme forces where one theme force can take just about everything in the other theme force, right? And it's like, well, what can we do this other theme force to make it more, you know, since it's more limited selection, like, should the requisition options be better? Should it have stronger benefits? Or is it simply a rework of the theme force completely? Also, apparently, the landscapers are coming by, so I hope no one can hear that.
Just a random leaf blower going by. No problem. So we'll have this be maybe the last question of this episode. Zap Brannigan says, will the drug-focused Crucible Guard be a new theme or incorporate into existing themes?
There is a chance for a new theme force, but it needs to have... The difficulty is I don't know that we are adding enough models to necessarily require a completely new theme force. And Crucible Guard's not getting a mixed faction mashup theme of any kind.
Mm-hmm.
So I find it doubtful, but not impossible. But I would say it's too early to say.
Okay. Well, I think I lied. We're going to throw in one more Crucible Guard question here from Imperial.
How dare
he you. Says, are you reworking Lucas since he's everyone's favorite drug addict?
So we have our sketch of things we'll be looking at model-wise, and that sketch is growing. Because just so everyone knows, like, we just did the, like, Legion just went live. We're mid Trollblood CID, which requires a lot of our playtest of the alterations we want to make. We're finishing up the internal playtest cycle for the Defiled Archon, Death Archon, and Isaiah the Dread Harvester. And we're in the early playtest cycle. We're about middle playtest cycle for the Retribution stuff. So that means we're about to hit the early playtest cycle for the Crucible Guard stuff. That's not including a bunch of other stuff that might be happening that people don't know about, so I can't talk about that stuff, but there's other things we're also playtesting and working on. So we have a sketch of some of the Crucible Guard legacy models that we want to touch and ideas. So Lucas very well may be updated, but it is way too early for me to confirm 100% whether or not he will be.
Okay, that's fair enough. So before we sign out on this episode, Will, is there anything that you were wanting to touch on or say before we move on?
I'd say for anyone who doesn't know, we have a new community manager, Lauren. She is helping out in the War Machine Horde's Facebook general group, answering people's questions, anything that they might have or that they're wondering about. So if you haven't been by the Facebook in a while and you have anything specific, she's a really great person to ask if you're like, hey, Privateer Press, I'm wondering about that. Also, you can always just email frontdesk@privateerpress.com. Other than that, just keep paying attention to the Privateer Press Facebook feed and Twitter feed and all that kind of stuff, because there's some exciting new announcements coming up in the very near future, especially in October, and I wouldn't want people to miss them.
Awesome. Okay. So as always, check out discountgamesinc.com for all your Privateer Press purchases and needs and desires and
dreams, yes, and hopes.
Yeah, all of that. And Muzon Minis for your gaming accessories. So, Will, thank you very much for joining this episode. I appreciate it.
I appreciate you, Jay. Every day I get to talk to you.
Huzzah! And thank you, everyone, for listening, and stay tuned for the bonus episode.